You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2013 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject, Solomon and Delilah. This class is titled, Siren Song from Lebanon, Beloved's Character and Her Effect on the King.
Good morning again. I very much enjoyed Dairon's exhortation and encouragement to us yesterday to always actually have Bibles open and looking at the Bible. Not that you have to do that during this class, since Bible verses will be on the screen, but one thing I thought I could ask of you, if I may, if you have time, have a read through the Song of Songs. The last major book I spoke a lot about was Job, and it's just too big to read in a single sitting. But the Song of Songs is actually conveniently a very small book. It may advertise itself as 8 chapters. In reality, it's only 117 verses, so that's about 3 chapters by sort of average length. So it's certainly quite small enough to sit down and read at a single sitting in 20 minutes or so. So if you have a chance this week, I think that would bring the material directly to your attention. Here we are then, and this is the only slide that I'm repeating from yesterday, the idea that this is the model or the structure that I'm going to try and suggest to you. Israel's spiritual leader is Solomon, and he is clearly and deeply in love with this beautiful Lebanese bride of his. But what's really going wrong here is the idea that whilst love is good, and whilst even the sexual love that they enjoy as a married couple is very beautiful and powerful and a good thing and a blessing from God, because it's such a powerful thing, it can actually displace one's God. She doesn't know the God of Israel, and he is a weak leader, and he's not going to introduce her to him. Perhaps he fears that it might damage the relationship somehow if he starts talking about all this foreign religion that she might not want to know about. And I wonder how much that might impact us today in the 21st century in relationships we form. Is our first thought to say, well, that my first responsibility in any relationship is to witness to the power and the meaning of my God? Or is it, well, that might get in the way a bit, so let's leave that till later, and maybe later it doesn't come around? I think that's what happens here in the Song of Songs, and that's why it's such a relevant passage for modern life. So what have I said? She does not know God. She's from Lebanon. He abdicates his responsibility to witness to her, so he is culpable for the fact that this relationship is not centered on God. Leadership, as we'll see, will pass to her, and we know from the book of Kings that that's what traditionally happened with Solomon and many, if not all, of his brides, that he was such a servant to their needs and their desires, he even ended up worshipping their gods when they had them and not his own. And so as a result, their relationship becomes, even though it's not his intention or hers, it actually becomes lethal. And I'm going to suggest that we're going to see clues to that end within the text of the song itself. And that's going to help us understand also the dynamics of the relationships that establish between her, the bride, and other key group characters. The daughters of Jerusalem, from whom Solomon, in a way, should have chosen his bride. And I mean that in a spiritual context more than a geographical one. And I'll qualify that at the end because it's not entirely true. And also we'll see that the watchmen of Jerusalem have a very, very tense and indeed hostile relationship to her, because they then see her as contributory, whether it's her intention or not, to drawing Solomon away from God. And therefore the whole of the city of Jerusalem, the people of Jerusalem, are threatened to lose their God and their service and their worship of their God. Let's see to what extent that's true. Now, I'm going to make a note here because I referred yesterday to a number of Hebrew experts who are very helpful in taking this Hebrew poem into an English poem that I could then understand as an English speaker. And I defer to them entirely when it comes to the meaning of Hebrew words and when it comes to the creation of an English text from which I can work. I defer to them entirely. However, when they step forward there in matters of exposition, I feel that I don't have to defer to them entirely. I feel that I can stand on my own in terms of one who's familiar with the Bible and say, well, I don't think you've got it right here. I find to my surprise that most modern expositors deny that Solomon is a character in the song, despite the fact that he's mentioned 7 times. or rather the only male name that ever appears is Solomon's, and it appears seven times. So if you're going, as you might default to do, to believe that the Song of Solomon is written about the character of Solomon, and I do, in the literal sense, and there's a figurative sense behind that, then what you might find in academic communities is that you'll be arguing from one side of a fence where you're maybe in the minority, and that many of the so-called experts in Hebrew will say, no, Solomon isn't even in the song at all. So I think it's worthwhile, since we consider ourselves a community of Bible students, to back up and to look for additional evidence beyond just the appearance of the name as to why we can say, no, this is Solomon in this song. So first of all, I've got a little bit of ahead of myself. Just look at the opinions that they put forward. King Solomon is a central figure in the lover's fantasies, says Block, but not a character in the poem. The two lovers are every man and every woman, says Gledhill. They have nothing to do with Solomon. And finally, King Solomon is not one of the characters of the song, from Fox. So in each case, these pronouncements are very clear. What surprises me, having read each of these and several other expositions, is I've yet to actually see a reason given for why they don't believe Solomon's in the song. You'd think it would follow naturally from a statement of that degree of confidence that they would say, and here's why. But I have never yet encountered a reason given, and I wonder if perhaps it's just been around so long that each expositor who wants credibility now realizes he has to repeat this in order to sort of join the crew. But these are experts in Hebrew, but they're not experts in exposition. So let's expand on that. I'll just take Gledhill from the middle there and show you his reasoning in more detail, or rather lack of reasoning, but his pronouncements. That's a bit busy, that slide. But what I've got here on the left-hand side are the verses from the song that seem to imply the existence of royalty or the existence of King Solomon, and Gledhill's pronouncement that Solomon's not there. And what I want you to notice is partly the confidence with which he speaks, but the lack of evidence that's supplied to bolster the opinion. Look, it is Solomon's carriage, says the song. The two lovers are every man and every woman. They have nothing to do with Solomon. Okay, well, why not? If it's Solomon's carriage, there's no explanation. The king appears in chapter 1. Again, he attempts to explain, that's part of the royal fiction. Okay, a banquet hall appears in chapter 2, and Block goes so far as to say that that Hebrew word has never been used in metaphor. It always refers to a physical banquet hall, as it appears also in the book of Esther. Well, perhaps in the girl's imagination is the explanation given. Look at the fourth one. Look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. Seems pretty clear, doesn't it? We have distanced ourselves from the idea that a strong narrative thread can be found in the song. This enables us to avoid the difficult questions posed by this passage. I find that, well, I suppose I understand your laughter, I find that particularly disappointing. It's as if he's used his model to say, because I now insist on my model, I'm not going to accept certain things that the song gives me. That's not the basis that we want to use. We want to actually say, let the Bible interpret itself. Whatever the Bible prompters there are, we'll try and use them to build our opinions. She is a prince's daughter, which sounds very reasonable that a king might marry. We are under no obligation to take it literally, he says, which is true, but we're under no obligation to take anything anyway, but it doesn't seem like a sensible way to move forward. I asked the question, well, if God really wanted to write about Solomon, a song about Solomon, what language would appear, if not this language right here? How can it be literal if indeed this is clearly not? So, all that does is show you that the case for saying Solomon is not there seems to be, in my opinion, very weak. That, again, is the negative. Let's turn immediately to the positive. What then is the case for it being Solomon in the song, beyond that of the name appearing, which clearly doesn't satisfy, curiously, the majority of modern expositors? And so what I'd like to show you by means of evidence is at least three metaphors that are called upon in the song that make sense, as indeed any metaphor must make sense. It only makes sense if the person invoking it has some experience of what they're talking about. I was talking with John Launchbury just yesterday, and I was asking him to describe the acceleration one has from riding on a motorcycle, which is something I haven't done. And I was just suggesting to him, was there a comparison with the thrust one experiences from being on an aircraft. And he was able quite clearly and quite articulately to explain that it was an entirely different set of experiential circumstances that were in play. And I realized, therefore, this is why I don't use the metaphor of accelerating on a motorcycle, because I don't have that experience. And I would have misused it had I done so. Here are the metaphors that are employed. I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot's horses. Every girl likes to be called a horse, obviously, so that's going to work well. She also rejoices in the fact that they are surrounded by henna, nard, saffron, calamus, cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, myrrh, aloes, and all the finest spices. And finally, he says, 60 queens there may be, and 80 concubines, and virgins beyond number, but you are unique. So I want to think about the who is in a position to make that kind of metaphorical statement or physical statement literal. Let's start at the bottom and work up. 60 queens there may be and 80 concubines. Now, that technically that could be said by anyone or any man to his beloved about how he loves her more than any woman. But think about how the Bible has shown us that Solomon particularly has this polygamous relationship. And while it's foreign to my mind as to why any woman would feel valued if she was shared among so many, culturally that's clearly what has happened in times and cultures other than my own. Solomon held fast to many women, in fact, in love, 700 wives, 300 concubines. So it makes sense and it becomes meaningful. We're shown by the Bible that Solomon fell deeply in love with multiple queens and concubines. The majority of Israel's citizens did not. They were not in a position to invoke this metaphor, this statement, in any meaningful way. If you doubt me, brethren, gentlemen, try it out for yourselves. Turn to your own beloved and say, I love you more than 140 women I've never met. And see how that works. It's nice in a way, but it's not really that powerful, is it? Let's move upward through the list. She speaks of henna, nard, saffron, calamus and cinnamon, myrrh and aloes. Realize, most of those spices are not native to Israel. So most of the Israelis at that time would never have encountered any of those things. Hands up, in all honesty, who knows what calamus is? Because I don't. No, none of you. Okay, and second question. Hands up anyone who's ever invoked a statement or metaphor involving the word calamus. And I suggest to you those two answers. Hands up if you can actually raise your hand. Excellent. Good. It's important science to do that control test. Otherwise, my data is meaningless. But yes, those two things are related. You haven't used that word because you don't know what it is. So whoever has used this word, by implication, does know what it is. So who is it that is an expert botanist? What does the Bible say? If we let the Bible interpret itself, it tells us, well, Solomon spoke about plant life to some great extent, apparently. From the cedar of Lebanon, how ironic, to the hyssop that grows out of the very walls. He knew plant life inside and out. You might counter, yes, but that's her speaking. Indeed so. Was she going to be exposed to any of these fine spices? What else does the Bible tell us? Never again were so many foreign spices imported as those the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. So Solomon and those in his retinue were exposed to foreign imported spices, like cinnamon, like calamus. The majority of Israel's citizens wouldn't have the faintest idea what any of these things, or what most of those things would be. Henna, for example, was indigenous, but most of the rest were not. Okay, so straight away, this is good Bible evidence that this is Solomon that's being referenced. This is the Bible explaining and expositing itself. So even if for some reason people are not convinced that it's Solomon, even though the name Solomon is used, there is additional data we can bring forward to make a strong case that is who we're talking about. And perhaps most compelling of all, and very interesting, is this one we started with. I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot's horses. Who knew about Egyptian horses? Again, what does the Bible tell us? Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kuwait. How interesting. Why would that detail even be in the Bible? But it's helpful in helping us understand a completely different book. They imported a chariot. Oh, look, he knew about Pharaoh's chariots. They imported a chariot for 600 shekels and a horse for 150. So there we are. We're told the Bible is explaining itself. Solomon knew about Pharaoh's chariots and horses. The majority of Israel's citizens did not. And in fact, if you were a rural, a peasant, as it were, unless you'd been conscripted into the army, it's highly unlikely you would have even seen a horse, much less known about the finery of Egyptians' chariots. Now, one thing I said earlier was, because God wrote this song, he's able to put into the mouths of the speakers more wisdom than they know. So I think some of their pronouncements have insights that they don't know about at the time, but are very meaningful. And this is one such example. To be a mare among Pharaoh's chariots, horses, does anyone know what that's sort of invoking? Pharaoh's chariots, horses are drawn by stallions. Someone has loosed a mare among the stallions. This was once done as a military tactic. In fact, just before the time of Solomon, Battle of Kadesh in 1274 BC, the Hittites were fighting the Egyptians, and the Egyptian chariots were drawn by stallions, so the Hittites very intelligently released a load of mares who were sexually in heat into the fray. You can immediately, you don't have to have great horseman knowledge to know, this caused chaos and derailed the king's campaign. But think about, therefore, the spiritual insight that's imparted by the author. Solomon has said to this woman, you're like something, you're like someone who's so sexually attractive, you'll derail a king's campaign. That's interesting, isn't it? What fabulous insight. How fabulous and how fascinating is the Bible when we hear it on its own terms, because that's unfortunately exactly what's going to happen. So, there we are. So here is some of our strong evidence that we're talking about Solomon here. Whether we're talking about mares among Egyptian stallions, whether we're talking about imported non-native spices, or the fact that there are 60 queens and 80 concubines, each of these statements is referenced in the song in chapters 1, 4, and 6, respectively. And when we look at the scriptures to give us some help and understanding, we learn that realistically these comments are only meaningful if they are uttered by the one with the relevant experience. In that case, Solomon, and therefore we conclude, I think with some confidence, Solomon is the male character of the Song of Songs. It may seem to have taken a long time to get somewhere that what seemed like a reasonable assumption to start with, but I make no apology for taking that much time, because as I say, the majority of academics will not take that view. So it's good if you have that information and have that grounding to be able to confidently argue that for yourself. And in fact, we can identify not only the character, but also, to some extent, his state of mind. If we're at the point where there's 140 partners, we know how many partners he's going to finish with, which is approximately 1,000. So if there's 140 partners, give or take, then there's 860 partners still to come, which was officially, commanded as something not to do in the law, to take many queens. Which means what? What does that mean in the context of this deep and intense relationship? It's early. But what is the consequence for this relationship? Realistically, it's not going to last. So when you're reading this incredibly intense thing, even though technically it could last while 860 new ones are brought in, but the idea of my dove, my perfect one is unique, might grow a little stale on her ears as dozens and scores and hundreds of new girls are brought into the harem. She might call him up one night. Hi, it's a perfect one, Miss Unique here. You remember me, of course. Right? So we're really looking at a man who is in his foolish period, because Solomon certainly had wise periods in his life. But this, then, is identified as the period during his foolishness, during the time that he's looking to indulge himself rather than to espouse the wisdom that God gave him. What do we know of the two of them? I suggest to you that the evidence is reasonable that they are married. They, for example, we'll find in chapter 1, there's a reference to the fact they share a bed, they share houses, and they share rafters of those houses. There's reference to common property, to common living experiences. The king calls her my bride no fewer than 6 times, and whilst one can call one's fiancé one's bride, I've heard that done, the most natural interpretation is that they are married. And finally, of course, we notice that the wedding, well, probably the wedding relevant to the song, is mentioned in the past tense as early as chapter 3. So the bulk of the evidence taken reasonably is that they're married. And part of the reason that I bother to put that up is because, again, the prevailing opinion is to the contrary, both in the academic world and, as far as I've discovered it, in this community as well. The bulk of the evidence, the bulk of the opinion is that they are not married. And to take it from the expert's view, they say, the modern commentators, and very reasonably say, they argue the couple are unmarried because it's apparent from the faint plot line that we see that they live in separate domiciles. And there's some truth to that. And they argue very logically, well, look, grooms don't live apart from their brides after the wedding day. But there's one exception for that, isn't there? Except for Solomon. Of course, once you've thrown out the idea it's Solomon wrongly, you might make this mistake. But the Bible will explain itself. Solomon brought, for example, Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David to the palace he had built for her. Because he said, and look at the reasoning, my wife must not live in the palace of David, king of Israel, because the places the ark of the Lord has entered are holy. So that's how Solomon began his polygamous existence, building separate palaces for the early brides, because he was trying at least to keep Jerusalem holy. And he sort of kept his what he recognized as unholy on the periphery. It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Didn't work out that well. So let's look now at the bride, and what we're going to see in her is then, given what we've said so far, what we'll see is a foreign girl, and again I mean that in the spiritual and religious context, in other words, a girl who does not worship, who does not know the God of Israel, and therefore someone who is, unless brought into that idea, if the relationship persists with no emphasis on the importance of the God of Israel, then it potentially becomes dangerous. And that's what we'll see in the song. We'll see language which has these little hints of great danger. Not that the bride is culpable, ironically, for this danger. The culpable party is the one who knows God and won't share the knowledge of God with her. But even so, it will make the relationship itself have elements of that which is lethal. And the Song of Songs, as I said yesterday, is the one book of the Bible that has more rare and unique Hebrew words than any other. And we're going to look at some of those very rare words. Why? Because if it's a very rare word that's used, there's only a few other or one or two other uses in Scripture. And we can use those as key points or anchor points or precedents to understand the reference that's been used in the song. I'm getting ahead of myself again. She is at least from Lebanon. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. And there are three other verses that give that same idea. The bride is foreign. So she's not a daughter of Jerusalem. She's also referenced as a Shulamite, by the way. Don't think I've overlooked that. That occurs in one verse only. We will be coming onto that a little bit later in the week. So just put that on a mental shelf for one moment. There's a lot of meaning in that term. And so automatically I'm beginning to understand why there's a group of characters called the daughters of Jerusalem, because she's not one of them. She's presented in counterpoint. There's her, the bride, and then there's, by counterpoint, the daughters of Jerusalem. So you can see, and she says this, if only you were to me like a brother, then if I found you outside, I would kiss you and no one would despise me. This, by the way, is the only other reason that modern commentators say that shows they're not married. Because if they're not married, they couldn't have public displays of affection like that. And that is true. But I think what they're overlooking is that it's also true they can't have public displays of affection like that if there is, as in, for example, the times of Ezra, the idea of marrying into a separate religion, and a separate religion from which you're not trying to make a convert, you're merely perfectly comfortable with the idea of this incongruous match. So there is tension because of her different nationality, because of her different God. And I think this is the tension that's being revealed in her statement, her quite innocent statement there at the beginning of the final chapter. That's why they can't necessarily share public affection publicly without her experiencing some scorn or some bad feelings from those in Jerusalem of the tribe of Judah. And so then we see Solomon's spiritual collapse, and it's very well documented in these six verses here. I won't need to read them all to you. You'll know them. I just underlined a few. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women. Solomon held fast to them in love, and his wives turned his heart after other gods. And that, again, I'm not inferring culpability even on the wives here. they're doing the right thing in the sense that they're speaking up for the gods in which they believe. And Solomon won't speak, but sadly their gods are no god at all. But Solomon will not speak up for the god which he knows to be true. And so as a result, this is how the disaster comes about. Their foreign influence, but his weakness, is the principally culpable element. I don't know, just quick show of hands, it might be only my own experience, but has anyone ever heard the idea that Solomon married all these brides in order, because he was politically shrewd and cunning, to set up a sense of peace around? Seems relatively common. So I have no intention particularly to disabuse you of that notion, but the more I read the Bible, the more I realize that idea never came from the Bible. I mean, it might be true, but that's not what the Bible says. The Bible says this guy just went head over heels in love with just about every girl he saw. So it really doesn't paint the picture of a politically shrewd and wise man making these alliances for reasons of peace and stability. It's not a bad suggestion, but it doesn't come from the Bible. So I'm now a little bit suspicious of it. And in fact, when I stop to think about it, I think, well, exactly how many surrounding countries are there? There's about four. So you still have at least 996, you know, pleasurable girls on top of that. So I don't think that really is the underlying factor. I think it is, as the Bible says, it was about his susceptibility to love that was the driving factor. And so let's go through and have a look at some of the, these are each very subtle, but have a look at some of the allusions, the subtle allusions I'm going to suggest that speak of danger with reference to this relationship. 60 queens there may be, 80 concubines, my dove, my perfect one is unique. 60. I'm not big on numerology. I think numbers have become overstrained in many religious environments and given too much meanings. That's not even a relatively common biblical number, is it? It's not a 7, it's not a 12, it's not a 40. 60, I'm not going to try and give it any special meaning. But I've heard that number somewhere before. So have you. Where? Something could have been 60 cubits high, the temple. Wow, you've got a good memory. The one that I'm looking for, not because it's pre-chosen per se, but because it's the only other mention, it actually is in the song. You've met it before in the Song of Songs. Two mentions of 60. There were 60 queens. There was also 60-something else. Pretty good. Excellent. Yes, good, Mary Ellen. And there are 60 warriors, right? Look, it's Solomon's carriage escorted by 60 warriors prepared for the terrors of the night. Is that a coincidence when it's written by God? Could be. But how interesting that the song chooses to give him 60 bodyguards when he's got 60 queens for a man whose devotion to his queens is going to lead to the end of his spiritual life in a way. Could be just a coincidence, but it's interesting, isn't it? How fascinating, therefore, maybe that gives us a hint. We're never told what the terrors of the night are, or perhaps we are. Spiritually speaking, I don't think the terrors of the night were ever outside of Solomon's bedroom, or in fact ever outside of his bed. That was what his danger was, but he couldn't see it. And so God, in this inspired song, has given him 60 bodyguards for 60 queens. But I don't think he notices it. But it's good if we notice it, because I think it's an important thing. Love is as strong as death, this love. It's jealousy as unyielding as the grave. That's an unusual metaphor, isn't it? I mean, Hallmark, the card company, think about every cutesy phrase you could ever come up with. I released my line of, you know, this is my death grip, honey, and it just didn't sell. I don't know what's wrong with the market. I pulled it out of the song itself. And again, so jokes to one side, some of these hints are more obvious than others. This is a love whose strength is compared with death and the grave. There are other strong things that are more positive that could have been chosen if this was a positive union. There's a repeated emphasis here that this love may well prove deadly. Okay, let's move on. There's a number of associations. These are the only associations we find that point any sense of culpability at the bride herself. Again, I don't think that's the common theme. But I've noticed, and it's more clear even in the Hebrew phrases than the English, that you'll find that each of these clauses describing the prostitute or the attractive woman of Proverbs 7 is repeated in the song. Her feet never stay at home. They're now in the street, they're now in the squares. The bride says, all night long I looked on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I will get up now and go about the city through its streets and squares. And this clause is an exact match. And it doesn't stop there. We move down. I have covered my bed with colored linens from Egypt. We've already said, when I see you, says Solomon, I see elements of things from Egypt. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. We've seen that before. Our bed is verdant, she says. My beloved has gone down to the beds of spices, the beds of cinnamon, myrrh, and aloes. Myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. And come, let's drink deeply of love till morning. Let's enjoy ourselves with love. Until the day breaks, i.e. all night, until morning, and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. There's a match in each of these clauses as it steps down. There's a wise woman in Proverbs 8. And you can't find any Hebrew phrase matches from Proverbs 8 to the song. They all four sequentially come out of Proverbs 7. I don't wish to sort of indict anyone, but that's just a match that I've noticed, and it's important that we listen to what the Bible's telling us. We said yesterday there's no mention of God in the song, and what one of the very interesting ways I find to notice that is in the nature of oaths that are sworn. There's three oaths, or more accurately, there's one oath that's sworn three times in the song. And oaths are always sworn in the name of the highest authority. So the courts will try and get you to swear in the name of God. And that's not wrong in itself, except Jesus says, look, that's very unwise because humans are weak, so don't swear at all. And so as a community, we forbear from that. But if someone doesn't believe in God, they don't swear by God. But they swear by whatever's valuable to them. They swear on their mother's grave. You've heard that phrase. They swear on the lives of their children. I find that particularly distasteful. But, you know, that's what I've heard, right? Because it's the most valuable thing. It's the highest authority they've got. In the classic case in Scripture, God says, I swear by myself because I could swear by no greater. I'm the greatest thing around, so I have to swear by myself. In the song, they swear by the animals. There is no God. It's the natural world is a beautiful and powerful thing. It's a wonderful thing. No one is trying to indict the natural world. But when you take God out of it, then that's the most powerful thing that's left. I adjure you. That's what tells you it's an oath that's coming. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you stir not up or awaken love until it pleases. Three times we see that oath sworn. Is it relevant that she actually sees him as a gazelle? And so she's asking them to swear by that which she sees as him, and he's obviously very important in her life. Don't know. Don't mind either way. Either way, I think the point is made that you're having a very, a sort of a natural God or a God of nature is all that's remaining at this point. Now I'm going to look at four terms. We promised this for a little while. Four very rare words that show up in the song. And they do exist elsewhere in the Bible, but only one or two times each. And so we can use those one or two times to act as anchor points to understand what's going on. My lover is to me a cluster of henna blossoms from the vineyards of En-Gedi. For what it's worth, En-Gedi is right there. And they're very beautiful vineyards. I've never been there, but I've only seen photos. But it's perched right on the edge of the Dead Sea. Life-giving water from the rivers that become waterfalls there actually goes straight over the edge and drop plonk into the Dead Sea. Now, that might be a little over-interpretation and overstretching on my part, but it happens to be the case. More importantly, what does the scripture show us of En-Gedi? And the answer is, En-Gedi is invariably on the only two occasions it shows up where the man of God was in mortal peril for his life. In one case, David, pursued by Saul. In one case, Jehoshaphat, who was said to tremble exceedingly because he was sure he was about to be overcome by the enemy armies. So we have somewhere which is beautiful but perilous to the man of God. These are the vineyards that are called upon. That seems at least an unfortunate choice, unless it's deliberate and intending to warn us that there is a possibility, a suggestion that the relationship he takes up with her may prove to be deadly if he is not godly and not strong to witness his God. The second word I want to look at is the redid, the shawl. They took away my cloak, she testifies, the Hebrew redid, those watchmen of the walls. I don't know what you think of when I think of cloak, but really this should be thought of as a very thin, shimmery veil. So I'm not sure cloak is a great English word, but the Hebrew word is clear as what it is. There's only one other mention in the whole Bible, and it's a garment that's worn by Judah. She puts it on when she decides to play the prostitute, says God. And so God says in Isaiah 3, the Lord says, the women of Zion are haughty, flirting with their eyes, strutting along with swaying hips. In that day the Lord will snatch away their finery, the bangles, headbands, mirrors, etc., all the way down to this word here, shawls, the Hebrew radid. And that's the only other mention in the whole Bible. So again, a very unfortunate match at best, unless that's a deliberate attempt to say, look, this is a very sexually enticing woman. But this is a dangerous context for you, Solomon, because you're weak and you won't preach your God. Similarly, the smell that's coming out of her bedroom door, the mandrakes send out their fragrance. At our door is every delicacy. Mandrakes? How unfortunate that it would have to be mandrakes. There's only one mention in the Bible. And by the way, the Hebrew word there is dudaim, which is directly related to dodim, the verb for lovemaking, that very common word in the song, simply because the root was believed to be an aphrodisiac. So it was called the lovemaking root because it was believed that's the sense it would induce. And the sole biblical appearance is where Leah buys a night with her husband, if I may say it that way, using the mandrakes that had been collected by her son. When Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet him. "You must sleep with me," she said. "I have hired you with my son's mandrakes." So Jacob slept with Leah that night. It's all a rather unfortunate relationship in that context. That's what Leah had to do. I'm not blaming Leah here, because I'm more blaming Jacob, who put her to one side as if she was something he never really wanted. So she has to buy him with mandrakes. This is the only other reference in the whole Bible. It comes back to be the scent from the door of the Lebanese bride. Again, sexually enticing, an aphrodisiac, but dangerous in this context. Here's a very innocent-looking word. What could possibly be wrong here? I belong to my lover, and his desire is for me. Very, very innocent indeed. But this Hebrew word, it's unfortunate they've chosen just a regular word, desire, from the English language, because that word appears very many times in the Bible, the English word. But that Hebrew word is very rare. It's not the regular word for desire, which begins with B in Hebrew, and I've forgotten what it is. It's a very rare word, and it has a connotation which, whilst it can apply between a man and a woman, it also applies as the desire that a predator has for its prey, the desire of a beast to devour its food. It's only been used twice before in the Bible, very close together actually, and right at the beginning of the Bible in the early chapters of Genesis. God speaks to Cain, and he says this, "If you do what is right, Cain, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires," that's that same tashuka desire, "to have you, but you must master it." So ask yourself, what feeling did sin have for Cain? It's not a romantic feeling. It's not an upbuilding feeling. Sin doesn't want to take Cain to the movies on a Friday night and buy him popcorn, right? Sin has a desire to consume, eat, and destroy Cain. And the only other mention is actually earlier. God says to Eve, "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. Your tashuka desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." Whatever that verse means, and it's not simple to understand, we can know at least one thing for surety. This was given to Eve as a curse. You don't get good things given to you as a curse. So it's the same desire sin has to Cain. In fact, this verse here in the song is an interesting reversal of what God has set up in Genesis 3. Your desire will be for your husband, he will rule over you. And she says, no, his desire is for me. And as we will see, she will take rulership over him. That much is clear. And so here are the only mentions of Tashuka in the whole Bible. Again, it's the desire sin has for Cain. To consume, a desire to consume, a desire to destroy. And finally, is this finally? Who knows? We'll find out. Solomon says, "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride, from the lion's dens and from the mountain haunts of leopards." Now, I know what lives in lion's dens. It's lions. And I know what lives in leopards' haunts. It's leopards, because I'm clever like that. So how interesting is it that in the inspired language of the song, he is calling to her as a predator? Come, lion. Come, leopard. Look at the way she speaks of him. Make haste, my beloved. You're like a gazelle or a young stag. She's the lion. He's the young stag. She's the leopard. He's the gazelle. Yeah, I can't see any problems with that. Can you? That should be a perfectly healthy relationship with no particular difficulties on the horizon. In fact, for one party, it should be a very nutritious relationship. But this is the language of the song. So if we just look with an open mind and with an open eyes and an open Bible and just look at what's being shown to us, these pictures are quite clear. She is the predator. He is the prey. There is a repeated emphasis that she is going to prove a deadly force to him because of his weakness and his inability to testify of his God. So let's just see, in summary, these little pictures that we've been shown. These aren't even all of them, but he's on 9 of them, and that's quite enough. That the vineyards, and tomorrow I shall argue that a vineyard is a representation of a fertile woman or a bride, and that's quite a common idea. The vineyards of En Gedi, the place where the man of God was in mortal peril. That she was like a mare loosed among the king's chariots that derailed them from their purpose. That there were 60 warriors, 60 bodyguards set aside for 60 queens. She was the leopard, he was the gazelle. She was the predator, he was the prey. She wore the Ridid shawl, which Judah wore when she prostituted herself religiously. She had 4 matches with the language, 4 Hebrew clause matches with the girl in Proverbs 7, not the wise woman of Proverbs 8. The smell of mandrakes were at her door. The desire they would share together was the desire that sin has to kill and consume, and their love would prove as strong as death. And when I'm reading this with just an open mind, because I promise you, you won't find this idea in the printed literature, so you're right to be suspicious. But as I'm just reading this myself, I'm seeing a lot of commonalities. I'm not seeing a lot of confusion. Everything's pointing one way here. And it's quite, if I'm just prepared to accept a complete contradiction of what I originally held as a view of this book, then the pictures are becoming very clear, and I'm beginning to see something that I hadn't seen before. And that's what I'm very happy and excited to share with you, and I hope it doesn't offend or trouble anyone. I'm not trying to do that at all or rewrite any, or knock over anything that existed before. I'm just sharing with you what I've seen. Each of those is a Bible verse. There are subtle infusions of deadly concepts, particularly when this word and this word and this word and this word exist almost nowhere else in the Bible. And when they do, they have the same theme between the 4 of them. Always deadly, often sexual. So those are the themes we see. And so what we're going to see is this power transfer from the house of David and the house of Israel. Remember, Solomon built separate palaces for these girls because the house of David must remain holy. And he speaks of the house of David. He seeks to praise her quite innocently. And he says, your neck is like the Tower of David built with elegance. That's how elegant you are. It's an innocent piece of praise. And when she returns to him, an equally innocent piece of praise, what does she say? She says, his appearance is like Lebanon, as choice as its cedars. So he naturally praises her in terms of David and Israel, because that's what's important and beautiful to him. And she praises him in terms of what is natural and beautiful and powerful to her, which is Lebanon. He's from David, she's from Lebanon. Chapter 4. Chapter 5. And then he praises her again in chapter 7. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. Didn't you mean the Tower of David? Oh, it's the Tower of Lebanon now. In fact, it's even inclined towards Syria. It's changed. What he sees as the elegant tower used to be his father's tower, David, the man after Yahweh's own heart. Yahweh's kind of drifted from his thoughts right now, and so has his natural father. He sees a new beauty. He sees now the beauty of Lebanon. And so there's been this sort of spiritual immigration where he started off in David, but because she was from Lebanon and she was stronger and of a more robust personality than he was the one who capitulated. And he came over to her way of thinking, and he came over to her side. And suddenly we have a complete flag of Lebanon as he sees as beautiful. You must not intermarry with them, says the God he's no longer listening to, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. And specifically, he's talking to weak-minded people. This is not saying that dating outside of our community is wrong. It is not. But you must be honest with yourself. Are you a leader? Are you a follower? Think about previous relationships that you might have had. They will determine which color flag takes over which color flag. Because the idea of this bi-stable flag never lasts for long. And in Solomon's case, he is a follower. So he has gone over to Lebanon. We'll see much more language of this tomorrow. We're going to look at the symbols. There's subtle allusion just in this sequence of his yielding and her standing firm, as she will announce at the end, I am a wall, not a door. He has been the door, she has been the wall. So, in summary, love can be intense enough to replace God if faith is weak. Love is an incredibly powerful force in this universe, and rightly so. It's a tremendous gift and blessing from God. But if it becomes stronger than our faith, and we align our love anywhere, then disaster can be around the corner. Even love which is pure and feels right can be fatal if it displaces God. And I think that's perhaps where the danger comes, in the fact that this problem doesn't ever smell like a problem. When you love someone, it will always feel right. The question is, do you notice your allegiance to God going further up or further down? One or the other will be happening. The love will always feel right. So when someone tells you, well, that's wrong love, you'll know in a way internally, you'll say, oh, no, you're wrong. This feels right. It will. It's bound to. But the question is, what is happening to your allegiance to the Tower of David? How could love ever cost me my faith, you might say? If I believe the truth, won't truth beat error? Sure it will. Truth will beat error every time on a level playing field. But we're deceiving ourselves if we think we value our quest for truth more than the celebration of pleasure all the time and every time. It's just a simple testament to the fact that whilst truth beats error, we don't always love truth more than pleasure. And so some pleasures simply will allow us to quickly say, I don't see the Tower of David right now. The Tower of Lebanon is beautiful to me. So those are what we've seen. That's nice, happy thoughts for the break, isn't it? So we will pick this up. You won't go trudging out of here with heads bowed at the end of the week, I promise. But for the moment, we have to walk some dark paths before we find the brightness. And what I want to do tomorrow, as we finish for today, is look at the symbols. And so if there's any possibility you can have read the Song of Songs by tomorrow, that would be wonderful. No problems if not. But it's going to be very useful because we're going to be looking at the common symbols in the song, and you'll be able to have the echoes in your mind to think, was that consistent with what I just read? I want you to be able to actually have the power to test this for yourself. Thank you very much for your attention.